but see some familiar faces. And Ken Murphy, our Oregon Director of Oregon Emergency Management, was a regular. And he actually was over in Newport yesterday. I was over in Jean's district at a salmon disaster meeting with Congresswoman Darlene Hooley. And we were asked early, well, I was asked to speak to this group quite a while ago and accepted that. And we kind of morphed it into having a field hearing of our committee. We're allowed to have three hearings during the interim period and one road show, and this is it. These are our roadies. This is Sandy. She is the committee administrator, and Aaron is the committee assistant. And they came over this morning, too. So we have some people signed up for testimony, and there's no time limit. And like I said, there's no, we're not talking about a particular bill. What I'd like to, and you can still sign up if you think of it as we move on, if you have ideas for legislation that you would like to see put forward, this is a perfect time to start thinking about that. Both of us, and we didn't plan this, both of us happen to serve on the House Democratic Majority Office Policy Group. And on Thursday, we'll be coming together for that on that issue by a phone conference call. And I've already got 10 ideas. And
it's actually postponed to May 1st, so you have a little more time.
Oh,
to put it together.
See?
I
always tell me last.
This morning.
Okay, good. Well, I haven't. I was busy driving. Well, so that's good. But anyway, it is good timing for us to be here today because we can bring any new ideas that have come forward. And we are happy to forward them. It's customary that you would work with your own legislator if you seriously want to do a bill, and it's easy to do. You just dial up or email and say, I want to do a bill, and if you can talk them into it, there's a process. If we represent any of you and you want to do that, just get a hold of us, too. I brought cards. Or you can just look us up online. And if you, even sometimes when your own legislator doesn't want to do it, others will, and we're pretty open to, especially this subject. So if you can't get your own legislator engaged, call one of us. And we are missing a couple of people here due to whatever circumstances. This was a road trip. It's always kind of hit and miss who you get. But Representative Wayne Krieger, who represents the lower left coast, as I call it, and Representative Donna Nelson, who represents Yamhill, McMinnville area, that area. And they're unable to come today. And Mike Schaffler, who represents Happy Valley in Clackamas County. And we will be joined today, or maybe a little bit later, by Representative Gene Wisnett.
If he shows up, he gets his name tag.
Yes. He does represent this area. And I spoke with Senator Ben Westland at lunch, and he is not able to come today. And Representative Chuck Burley was also invited, and I didn't personally speak to him. So they may show up. We never know. So without further ado, I'll call Kyle Walker from Portland General Electric.
Chair Boone, member of the committee, roadies. My name is Kyle Walker. I'm with Portland General Electric, specifically their Business Continuity, Emergency Management, and Corporate Security Department. We hold a unique designation in the energy sector as being one of the top 17 critical infrastructures in the nation per Department of Homeland Security. And just for context, we serve about 1.5 million customers, 4,000 square miles, 52 cities, 7 counties. So we have quite a bit of accountability on both sides of the hill. We're often first responders on a scene in the field and are frequently the first source of information regarding emergency disasters and electricity restoration. Let me give you a couple examples. Back in 2006, we had a massive storm that impacted the entire region, as you well know. I was operating in the EOC at the time. I had my foot in two seats. I was backing up our individual who does liaison work with the county EOCs, as well as our person who does the backup liaison work with key customers, everything from Intel and Nike. Here are the type of phone calls I would get in the private sector in our EOC. City of Portland. We want to know which neighborhoods are down, how many people are out of power, and specifically which street and what house address. Whoops. Water treatment plants. I had a call from a water treatment plant out in East Washington County. Obviously, this fellow had gotten, somebody had gotten him out of bed. When will he get our power back so we can start treating this water? We did get a call from Intel. We're in the middle of a major production. When can we expect our power since we are critical, critical to the economy? We are the first on site with down power lines. Milwaukee, we had several, City of Milwaukee, several lines down. We were the first to contact fire departments and stay on site before those public service, public safety responders were on site. Clackamas County, EOC, calling. Where are we out? How long will it be? How long will we be out? How extensive is the damage? Or the one that was most disconcerting to us was we called for mutual aid crews from other states to come and help us out. They couldn't cross state lines because of certain rules and regulations. We are a highly regulated industry, both at the national and state level. We don't receive the benefit of the public sector in the form of public grants, funding sources, as our public sector partners do. And I actually was in the public sector for 18 years, so I understand the context we're all sitting in here. More often than not, the electric industry, and specifically Portland General Electric, feels like we're left off the radar when it comes to addressing emergency preparedness, response, and recovery matters in the state. In fact, we have to carve out our own roles and develop our own partnerships independently. And we've got some good groups, independent groups, technical groups that we interface with. I'll give you another example that was very, very difficult for us as far as state interfacing, communication, cooperation when it comes to preparedness, response, and recovery. This last storm we had in December, while it didn't hit the metro Willamette Valley area, of course, it devastated York counties along the coast, which is Pacific Corps territory. Pacific Corps was calling and begging for mutual aid from our crews to go and assist. But before we did that, we wanted to make sure that our crews would be safe, that roads were clear, that indeed there was communications, that we would not be putting them in harm's way. Tried to call the state EOC, was unable to get through. It took me 45 minutes and many backdoor routes from my previous experience as working in a state agency to get into the EOC and solicit information so that we could make an informed decision to send our crews to support another utility. The information they gave me regarding the status of the events on the coast and the status of the transportation routes and the supply chains to and from was 12 hours old. In fact, we spend more time, as I said, partnering with regional partners to the north who seem to have a robust and inclusive set of audiences when it comes to emergency management. We participated last year in a pandemic event, pandemic tabletop, with Puget Sound Energy, King County, et cetera. But when it came to the state Pandora event, we were told there was not a role and would not be participating. The same came up here last week. We attended a planning meeting for your 2009 earthquake tsunami event. As we ascertained by the end of that day, there was also no role for the private sector and specifically utilities. There are constantly new Oregon administrative rules, restructuring of agencies, readiness planning, intelligence on threats, exercises, design and location of emergency resources. All these things impact Portland General Electric and other utilities' ability to effectively interface and support the safety and social normalcy of Oregonians. So what I'm submitting to you today is just keep us in the forefront. We're not an afterthought. We ask you to recognize our role and value in emergency planning, response, and recovery. Involve us as key stakeholders and affected interests and partners so that we can provide continuous, reliable service. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very interesting. Any questions?
Thank you,
Kyle. Oh, another constituent, Floyd Holcomb. Welcome. I saw you back there. Actually, he's not a constituent, but close by.
I feel like your constituent.
It's so close. I feel like you are.
I'm happy. I always tell people I'm.
Thank you so much for coming.
Well, thank you for allowing me to testify here. It's the first time I've got a chance to come in front of all of you. As you may have known, I was recruited by the Oregon State Defense Force after spending 25 years in Special Forces to become the representative for...
Floyd, can you introduce yourself just for the record, too?
Floyd Holcomb from Astoria, Oregon. I was recruited to become the state liaison for the State Defense Force for Columbia, Tillamook, and Clatsop counties about a month before our Hurricane Winds disaster. It was like out of the frying pan into the fire, and for 7 days we all lived in the Clatsop County EOC, realizing that I could not get communication to my Tillamook counterparts or my Columbia County counterparts. It was a very wide, eye-opening experience. So for my testimony today, I'd like to talk about two things. One is the importance of the National Infrastructure Protection Plan and communication to emergency operations centers in the state of Oregon. By the reliance on ham radio operators and the communication side, it realized to me after spending so much time at the national level on communications that our communities are still relying on communications that we've been using since World War II. And in this particular plan, we realized quickly that in our business, we look at communications as four elements. And it's called, it's real simple, PACE, primary, alternate, contingency, and emergency. On my first day into the night into the Emergency Operations Center, I wrote that four-letter word on the whiteboard and asked our emergency operation leader, Gene Strong, what our PACE plan was in communication. And unfortunately, ham filled primary, ham filled alternate, ham-filled contingency, and runners and ham was our emergency. So that was a very wide-opening eye experience. So I would like us to work on that. And I won't go into details because I'm sure you've heard a lot about it in the after-action report since the storm. The next level of areas I'd like to briefly touch upon is the National Infrastructure Protection Plan. I'm also the consultant to Portland and Western Railroad. It owns 525 miles of railroad. I'm also the consultant to the Port of Tillamook Bay Railroad, which has been devastated by this recent damaging storm. With fuel prices going the way they are, right now we have one rail line going to the coast, and that's Toledo. Our rail line going to Coos Bay is out of service. Our rail line going to Tillamook Bay is out of service. And unfortunately, our railroad going to Astoria right now is out of service. And I'll briefly update you on a phone call I received from the president of the railroad this afternoon. We have been working on restoring the Astoria rail line to Tongue Point for over 2 years. From a disaster that has happened in high extreme flood stages nearly 2 years ago, that wiped out a piece of railroad infrastructure in Napa. On Friday, we met with the Corps of Engineers. The railroad has an exemption for emergencies that can repair its system. The Corps of Engineers announced to us today that they're going to ask us to go through the full permitting process to repair 100 feet of outage of line. This, unfortunately, is going to put our critical infrastructure at an abandonment process, unfortunately, because we can't afford to look at that situation and go several months into an environmental process, and when you're just restoring systems back to its natural or its existing state. The Astoria line, for example, was built in 1897. Much of that rail line had been in place since 1897. Most of our rail infrastructure in the state has been since the 1800s. So I'd like for us to look at infrastructure a little bit more closely, if we could, and get your support in analyzing the fact that we do have critical infrastructure that may not just be the roads and bridges that our emergency services access, but we have to have alternative transportation. And in this particular case, it's opened my eyes that now we have rail out, and if we do have another flood stage this spring, like we're all predicting, it may even get worse. So thank you very much. I'm glad I was able to bring that to your attention.
Yeah, that's news. Any questions for Floyd? Thank you.
I got off easy. Thank you very much.
I'd like to welcome Representative Gene Wisnant, who represents Sun River. So this is your guy for this area here.
Well, welcome.
Thank you.
I hope you spend a lot of money. Central Oregon, thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm very glad that you took the time today to come over here.
If you don't like the weather, wait, it'll change.
Yeah, kind of like the coast.
We've been here for a few days. We're fulfilling your desire and have noted the weather.
I think the weather's great. I like snow. I'm a skier.
It's changeable.
I just wasn't skiing today. I was driving in it.
Tom Manning.
Another constituent of mine. And welcome, Tom.
Did you
report
everybody?
I did. I brought everybody I know.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to testify today. There's a couple of issues.
Identify yourself.
Oh, Tom. I'm Tom Manning. I'm an emergency management director for Tillamook County. And there's a couple of issues in which we've run into some very difficult permitting processes. It's not so much... where we run into a problem is jurisdictional authority. For example, we have a log jam that happens from the last flooding, and it puts some of our bridges or infrastructure at risk, or it takes out some of our infrastructure. And the log jam actually is resting on state property. It is in DSL's jurisdictional authority, where the high water mark they permit and they regulate. What they have done in the past, so they said, okay, we'll give you an emergency permit. Here it is. You can go out and fix it. Well, the problem is we legally can't spend county tax dollars on state property. And it's a real dilemma, and it's not just DSL. We've had the same problem with state parks. They said, well, we don't have any money in an emergency fund, so we'll give you a permit, and you can do this. And the problem is, for example, down in Nesquen, we had a bad winter storm, where Hot Creek was actually, the sand had washed up and blocked the creek flow. So much sand moved in that the creek couldn't flow to the ocean. What happened is it started backing up and flooding the community in Nesquen. So we brought in the Army Corps of Engineers. They looked at it and said, oh, yeah, this is a serious problem. We had state parks there and everybody, and they said, yeah, it is a problem. We're going to give you an emergency permit. You can hire the contractor and go out and open it up. And we came back and said, no, wait a minute, we can't legally do this. This is your jurisdiction. If we do anything on your property, you could put us in jail. You permit, you know, because it's their jurisdiction, their responsibility, and it is as if they were to put that responsibility back on the county by giving you the permit to do it. And so I dug my heels in, and I worked with the governor, and he actually ordered state parks to do that based on the findings of our council said that, you know, we can't spend our money, yet we're putting people at risk, so they went forward. But it seems as though where the problem lies is same thing with DSL. There's no emergency provision or funding in their budget to allow to do these types of removals. So it's a real hardship on the local governments because, and I'll tell you right now, a lot of the local governments have actually gone out and have done the work on their permits where technically, it's not their responsibility. And so that was one of the issues I wanted to raise before the committee today to look at. The second issue is back to communications, which was brought up earlier. One of the things that we found is we would like to get some redundant loops in our fiber optic. That way, when we lose a specific link, we could maintain 911 communications for Clatsop County and Lincoln County and Tillamook County. So we could have some kind of a backup system. The thing is, there are several fiber lines that are there, but according to the Public Utility Commission, Sprint and some of the other owners have no agreements to allow a sharing of that resource. It might be something to look at to see if, in an emergency, such a provision could be struck where we could share those resources, or if not, then to put in a redundant loop. I know Owen is working on some other issues on the microwave and hooking up some of these links via microwave, but I do feel that since we have such a large fiber network, especially on the coast, and as you know, Debbie, we had, we actually had some issues where, because of the interruption in Tillamook, we actually took internet service out from Australia, New Zealand, and Hong Kong. So Tillamook has some international issues, too, that are far-reaching on some of these fiber lines. So I think that infrastructure would be awesome if we could look at a way where we could put in these redundant loops. So if one goes out, we've got a backup loop, and that way we can maintain our 911 communications. Those are the two issues that I had brought today. So,
thank you. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I should remember my formality here, even though I'm a little informal today.
That's okay.
Have you had any, with regard to the redundancy and the additional fiber, have you had any conversation with Lincoln County about some of the work that they've done over the years with working with the PUC to get some ownership of extra fiber and some of that kind of conversation?
Yeah, I've been in a few meetings with Gene Strong, and maybe he can come in a little bit later and follow up on where that's going, too. But I know Lincoln County and the southern end, they're – I don't think they're tied in with us, and so that would be under the Sprint line, I think, that goes out to Sheridan is one of the main lines.
Just to kind of let you know where my thought process is going, why I would encourage you to talk to them, and it's been a few years and my memory banks aren't what they could be, but while I was commissioner, the local utility, Central Lincoln PUD, put in additional fiber, and we deliberately, they inquired if we'd like, and we said yes, put in more than they needed, and we went through an exhaustive court battle with the PUC to allow us to get ownership of that government entity. It's now rests with what's called CoastNet, an organization, so that they can resell some of that capacity. But our primary reason for doing it was to get excess capacity and to be able to build in some redundancy. So it keyed me when you mentioned the PUC and the other ownerships and that sort of thing. I don't know that these are parallel tracks, but there is some precedent that's been set by a neighboring county in terms of working with private ownerships and getting some into public ownership. So I would really encourage you to talk to Assistant Legal Counsel Rob Ovett in Lincoln County, who spearheaded much of that, or you know, have some of your folks that are working in the legal end.
Sure.
See if there isn't some way you can get onto some of the existing capacity as well.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm retired military, so I come with a little bit of background in some of this area. But how about satellite phones? If we're looking for redundancy, if both redundant lines go out, would satellite phones not be a better backup?
Well, the problem that we have is we had WorldCom, and their satellites going out of service. So what happens is you will be able to dial, then it falls off. It dials the fault. You can't really use it until they get their new satellite up on WorldCom. So that's a bad system, we found out, not the one to go with. The other problem with sat phones is that if we have a real heavy rainstorm, like a fade, like we do in Tillamook, same thing with snow, we lose our satellite. And unfortunately, too, if you're in the canopy of the trees, we have it for search and rescue. It doesn't work very well there either because of it absorbs. But if you're in an open area, it would work pretty well. We do have that in our EOC, Emergency Operations Center. And what we actually ended up using, because we do have a redundant fiber loop in Tillamook, so we had internet, and we were able to get on Skype and do some telephones, voice over IP, which actually worked out pretty well. But, yeah, good point. Thank you.
Yeah, Tillamook had some advantages.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Tom. Next we'll call Vicki Hargath from Columbia County Emergency Management. And unless you live outside of Vernonia, she's close to being a constituent. Welcome, Vicki.
Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to testify before you. I kind of just made up a list of things that I would like to bring up as well as ask for your support. During the special session, it's my understanding that a disaster relief fund was voted on and approved, and I would just encourage you to continue to support that. In Columbia County, as you know, and Vernonia specifically, coming up with the 25% match for most of the disaster relief is really, really difficult. And I know that the OEMA group has supported disaster relief fund for many years, but the previous attempt on setting up a fund, I guess, did not work or has been taken sideway or something. But with this current one, I hope that it continues to get funded and supported, and ask your support.
Well, we agree, and Representative Brad Witt, who probably is your representative, mm-hmm. that was his bill, one of his three bills for the special session. And although he didn't get as much money in it that he wanted, he requested $2 million, I think, and we got $500,000. But it's a start, and I can't speak for anybody but myself, but I intend to hold forth on that and continue to fund that, because you're right. It's not enough for the matching funds. And I don't know, maybe Ken Murphy knows how much FEMA money we left on the table or is still sitting there, who knows. But it seems like that's that whole system. And we talked about that just in that private meeting with Darlene Hooley yesterday, too. Maybe they could do something about that.
Not to sidetrack you, but it's been something that we've been working on since I remember in 1996 mm-hmm. when the flooding in Lincoln County really took us down, and we've been begging for this for a long time, so we've at least got a foot in the door.
Yeah. I think last time they started it with $1 or something, and they probably spent that on something else.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
No. I'm glad to have the discussion. The other thing is, going through this latest disaster, while we were fairly intensely in operations, emergency operations for the first 2 weeks, and we worked a lot with state OEM and their emergency coordination center. And like the locals, OEM is also desperately in need of more staff and more funding. I mean, it's real easy for us to blame OEM, but unless they have the support from their higher-ups as well as funding, you know, they really aren't able to support the local needs. So I don't know what is in the works as far as that. I've heard different rumors that the governor is considering funding them more, and now with them being under the military, I'm sure that gives them more support. But they haven't been supported well, and we don't have enough disasters where we really get a chance to observe it or experience it, and they desperately need support.
And I could comment on that, too. Our committee did forward a bill in the 2007 session asking for some funding. We asked Ken, you know, give us a wish list. What do you need? And we tried that, and it as many do, get stuck in ways and means because of the funding. And if you don't have everybody on board on that, and some people felt that the money wasn't, you know, that they'd rather see the money go somewhere else. But I totally agree with you, and we'll keep trying. And what one of the things that I didn't want to see, and I hope it doesn't, you know, happen, is that even though they're in the military department, people say, oh, they'll get all that Homeland Security money, or, oh, they'll get all the military money. And that's not true. They still have their own pockets to fill, so to speak, and they need to have their pockets full in order to give these services out. And I was lucky. We did have a committee hearing roadshow over to the temporary quarters not too long ago, and you know, saw everything that they were doing there, and that's once they're out back in the office. And they were out there. I got to see the FEMA people in action after the storm, and a lot of the OEM people there. They kind of go in and out. I can't tell the difference in some of these guys, but they're all working together, and they did a great job. And they're such can-do people. I mean, you can tell I'm a little bit of a supporter of that agency, but they do it without grumbling about it. They just do what needs to be done, and even though they don't always have the funding they need, they make it happen. So,
yeah.
Your request is loud and clear.
Also, one of the things that we did in Columbia County due to our minimal resources is we called in some incident management teams from the State Fire Marshal's Office and Washington County. And what that allowed us to do, or allows anyone to do if you establish incident management teams, is to have highly trained people that can come in and hit the ground running. And I know that the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association is interested in taking that to a higher level of support, and I believe that would have impact on the Mobilization Act, the Fire Mobilization Act, and funding for that. So not many organizations can afford the training and staff time that it takes to have a skilled incident management team, but if we did it statewide, I think that would be successful. And so if that comes across your vision sometime, if you could support that. I'm not sure what it will look like yet. It's in the very early stages, but it
sure.
Yes, Representative Lizzie.
That's an excellent idea, because I've had some observation experience with the firefighters over here in this side of the mountain.
Bet you have.
And they're really professional, again, from my military experience. And I can see where that would transition into sort of any sort of disaster, having that staff come in and be sure you're fed, you know, some place to sleep and transportation and all that. So that's an excellent idea, that maybe an MOU between the emergency management and the Department of Forestry would be excellent.
Yeah, they bring in a structure under the incident command system that they've used so often with fires, and it can work for any hazard. So let's see. Oh, one of the specific items I wanted to bring up related to Columbia County is in the Nehalem Valley, through this recent flood, it was determined that the Nehalem River Valley has some characteristics similar to flash flood zone, and they have very poor warning systems up there, and I'm not sure what exactly would work. But someone referred to it once as like sirens out along the coast for tsunamis, maybe some kind of siren system. But I know those aren't real popular. So, that's something that should be considered at some point.
That's a great idea. I know that the Fire Chiefs Association just agreed upon this week a uniform tsunami sound. So Cannon Beach won't be having their cows anymore.
Yeah.
But that's okay.
Also, I was going to bring up OWIN, and Tom brought that up. That's important that we support OWIN for improved communications across the state, as well as EOC, Emergency Operations Center, communication coordination through the internet with neighboring counties as well as with the state ECC. This is my wish list.
That's great.
I wanted to comment during the flood response in December, we had representatives from both the Oregon Defense Force and the National Guard in our EOC, probably starting the second day, and they were tremendous help. They were our liaisons into the state system, and they were able to provide us real-time information like I had never experienced before. So doing that is a very positive thing to do.
They were really, really good.
They were. And then the last thing I'll bring up is, as you probably have heard, the three schools in Vernonia are not going to be available for students for some time, if at all. And there's still a lot of debate going on what to do with them. But one of the things that that creates is economic impacts that I never really gave any thought to before. But, for example, the school system in Oregon is funded based on student enrollment. And Vernonia has had a 10% decrease in student enrollment right now, just after a few months. They expect to have upwards to 25% if they don't get their sports programs back running. Their gym was completely destroyed. So the economic impacts of disaster is something that, unless you're in economics, you don't really think about. But it has all kinds of reaching problems associated with it. And, you know, there are days when people talk about Vernonia drying up completely and people moving away, because the schools are kind of a central communication or community hub for people. And if they don't have schools, people will leave to find schools. So that's all I had to bring up. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions, comments? Well, and I appreciate that. I've just been in conference with the superintendent up there about the schools, and also the superintendent in Cannon Beach. Schools have to be moved. Seaside schools have to be moved, and they're talking about 5. So in my district alone, that's 8, and I haven't talked to the guys down in Tillamook yet. So it's very sobering thought to think of how much money that represents. And the other thing is, just as an aside, in Cannon Beach, there's just an elementary school there. I mean, it's K through 6, so it's a tiny thing right in the north end of town, the Quonset Hut. And that has been a subject of discussion for over 12 years. And they finally, after 12 years, found a location up on Spruce Street, which raised it up, I don't know, 30 feet or so. And now with the new maps that have come out, the inundation zone is like on the other side of the highway, and that's Weyerhaeuser land. And if you go up behind Seaside and Gearhart, there's all that timberland behind there. That's what I'm thinking, that, you know, all the water systems are up there, and fortunately they won't have to be moved. But for that whole area, that's, you know, they're looking at raising everything up, but in some cases raising up means going on to some completely different kind of geography. So, okay, with that happy thought, I'll bring up another constituent, Deb Truesdell. And Deb is from Seaside.
I think she stacked the deck today.
I really didn't. This is such a nice surprise to see everybody here.
We were just hoping to get some sun is what it was.
It'll happen. Jean's got that ordered. So if like everyone else, we'll make you introduce yourself.
Exactly. Madam Chair, thank you for having me, esteemed members of the committee. My name is Deb Truesdell, and I'm with Sterling Concepts and Communication, Inc. I was contracted about 15 months ago by the City of Seaside to be their tsunami prep coordinator. That contract was up last month, so I'm now a freelancer. And I'm here to talk about funding for tsunami and storm prep outreach and education. There are a few things that I'm not sure that this committee is aware of, so I thought I would bring you up to speed on a few little details about what's going on in the tsunami prep arena. DGAMI, Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, had put together a group of stakeholders. They convened this group about 5 months ago. It's come to be known now as TAG, Tsunami Advisory Group. The primary purpose of pulling this group together was to find all of the tsunami-oriented stakeholders throughout the coast and find representatives from each of those groups so that DGAMI would have a group that they could contact to get information. The specific impetus was the map, the new map in Cannon Beach. They wanted to get input from all of the beach communities on how to put that map together as far as the legend and the information and things. And so they thought it would be best to poll everyone before they just went ahead and did it. So that group has now been started. It's called TAG. On that group are represented are DGAMI, NOAA, OCZMA, OSU Wave Lab, OSU Extension, many numerous counties and numerous cities, and we've broken up into subcommittees, and so that's something that's been really good. As an interesting part of that, and I'm a member of that group as well, and I represent the outreach and education subcommittee of this group, and it's been interesting in talking with all these groups, George Priest and many other people that have been involved in this for years. They are very much in agreement that outreach and education is really the top priority right now, that a lot of other things have been addressed, the maps are coming along, but that outreach and education has really been ignored up until recently and is the number one priority, and there's also total agreement that it's the absolute least funded of those types of things. So wanted to put that out there. In Seaside, I just wanted to report a little bit, now that that project is complete, report on what the results of that has been. I was actually under the grant for 12 months, and then the City of Seaside extended my grant for 2 additional months. And out of that, we've created the beginnings of a whole new community in Seaside. We have, and the Great Coastal Gale, as they're referring to it, the huge storm, was really a test of what had happened with the tsunami prep program. One of the points that we like to make about the tsunami prep program is that we don't prepare just for tsunamis. We prepare to the level of tsunamis, which means we're prepared for any kind of emergency. I mean, we have our CERT teams, our community emergency response teams. They're trained to handle anything. So it's not just that we're trained for tsunamis and people don't know what to do in other emergencies. We train in general first aid, general information about all kinds of emergencies, and so that people have individual, family, and business emergency plans in place to handle everything up to and including tsunamis. And tsunamis and earthquakes are the biggest threat to us, and they're going to cause the most amount of damage. So what we have now in Seaside, because of this influx of funding that we were able to get, which we were very fortunate to do, we now have a CERT team, and we have a second CERT team going into training in May. We have a tsunami advisory committee that consists of about 15 community volunteers that have basically been groomed to take over where I left off and keep things moving forward. We have, this is astonishing, but since January, we have over 150 new ham radio operators in the Seaside Clatsop County area, and that's one of our volunteers is doing the training on that. That alone really increases the amount of emergency preparedness and personal responsibility for emergency preparedness, simply because the whole purpose of having a ham radio is for recreation and as a hobby, but in our county it's hugely used as a community resource, and as most people have already heard the story, the ham radio operators really saved the day in Clatsop County during the Great Coastal Gale. So we're very proud that all of that has taken place. So I just wanted to give you an update on that. We've got, in addition to that, we have a lot of community groups that have come together. I know reporting before your committee several months ago was the Seaside Chamber of Commerce, and they've put together this booklet for businesses to prepare, because a lot of businesses, I don't know how many of you have ever had clam chowder at McEwen's in Seaside, but they just opened up a couple of weeks ago. That's how long it took them to get back on track. It's amazing. There's my chiropractor's office still isn't opened up yet. It's amazing the kinds of devastation, and certainly Vernonia got the worst of it, but the devastation, the people that are losing their businesses because of these storms is incredible. And so at any rate, I know that I just wanted to reiterate what has happened and what we're hoping to happen in the future. And Representative Boone has been extremely encouraging and supportive of these projects. But again, we're looking for some funds and matching funds and some strategic help as far as putting together a program that's really going to do this. Because grassroots outreach changes communities. And I think the final message that I would leave you with is that because we have 150 new ham radio operators and because we have people in CERT and over 100 people that have gone through our training, over 400 people that have gone through the basic training and gotten NOAA weather radios in their homes, people were a lot better prepared during the big storm in December than they were before. And that meant that there was not as much reliance on the recovery and response. And that's a key thing, is that when we talk about emergency preparedness in this state, we're talking about recovery and response. And we have to begin looking at it in a two-part thing. There's recovery and response, which is critical, but there's also education, outreach, and mitigation, preparing ahead of time to make sure that the worst doesn't happen. So I'll be happy to share this flyer with you. I brought one for each of you. We're having a big emergency preparedness fair on April 30th at the Seaside Convention Center, and Representative Boone and Senator Betsy Johnson are going to join us. But we have DeGammy, the Wave Lab, all kinds of great speakers are going to be there doing presentations. So if you want a one-stop shopping place to get totally up to speed on as much as we can teach you about emergency prep and what's going on in one day, that's available there on April 30th.
Thank you, Deb.
Thank you.
Questions, comments? Well, I have to say Deb has been, and I'm probably sometimes her worst nightmare. She'll call me up and ask for stuff, and I'll say, but you've got to do this, you've got to do that. But what she has done as far as enlighten me to all this, she's let me know, and I've tried to bring this issue to my colleagues now. And it's easy for us to say we'll get funding for something like this, but when it just affects one little city in the state, and so we're looking at, I told her, you've got to go countywide, and then once you're countywide, we can bring your good news to the state house and go up and down the coast. And so one of my ideas for a bill this coming session is to do a coastwide emergency preparedness program so that we could apply it to all the cities along the coast. And that's the way that we can more easily, put it that way, more easily ask for state funding. And I think that once people see, and this is a great idea to have this fair, if you will, so that people can see what all can be done and how, as she said, it's not rocket science. It's just knowing what to do and what to expect and what you can do. And you're taking a good substantial group of people out of the need category for your, which in our case is mostly volunteer fire departments and first responders. And they're going to do their families first. Then they're going to go try to, as we did in the storm in our case, cut their way down the highway to get to the fire station. And from that point on, your recovery. And I don't have to tell you about recovery in your area, but anyway, that I think it's one small step that we can take in our state, and it'll have a huge impact overall. And maybe, just maybe, we won't have anything really big just for a while, but it's better to be prepared. So our final person who signed up to testify is Rick Carton.
Representative Boone, Representative Cowan, Representative Risnett. I'm Rick Carter, and I was going to speak as a private citizen, but Tom Manning basically blew my cover. I'm actually a senior utility analyst with the Public Utility Commission, and there's a few things that I'd like to discuss with regards to public utilities. The Public Utility Commission in the Energy Division and the Safety and Security Reliability section, we have responsibility for emergency support function 12 for energy, gas, and electric. And also, as soon as the letter comes out, we're going to have telecom laid in our bucket also. And personally, I come from a, I've only been with the commission since 2001. Before that, I had over 35 years with the local telephone company that serves Representative Cowan's constituency in Newport. And in fact, I worked in virtually every exchange that Pacific Northwest, Bell, U.S. West Communications, and Quest Communications have in the tri-state area, or when it was PNB. But anyway, what I'm getting away from, first of all, the December storm, we really got a triple whammy on that one when it comes to telecommunications. We lost the primary route along Highway 30. We lost the redundant route along the Tillamook Railway, and we lost the link between Sheridan and Salem. And the latter is the one that I'm concerned with the most. And in that particular incident, the folks in Lincoln County that lived outside of Lincoln City lost the ability to communicate with their emergency operations center in Newport. And from a telecommunications engineer's point of view, that could be rectified very easily by the fiber that is owned by Central Lincoln PUD that may extend over across the headland into Depot Bay and into Glen Eden Beach, and you could create a backfeed situation, and that would affect a redundant route for you. The way it is, the traffic is transported at this time has to follow the consent decree of 1984, which means it has to go back through the routes established through the local access transport areas or the LATA under Judge Green's order. Now, my memory's a little rusty. That takes me back a long time, but I think that may be the inhibitor for that route to be run through the incumbent telephone companies. So that may be a methodology that you folks could utilize. The same could be said for the South Coast region, not because it is a federal mandate, but because you have only one route in and out of the Coos Bay Reedsport area. And I think it was just this last year that service was interrupted at least 2 to 3 times by backhoes. It happens. Cables get cut. And it's not always a landslide or a hurricane or any other natural disaster that can wipe out telephone lines, but man can do a lot of damage themselves. So that may be another avenue for a redundancy to the South Coast region. That cable that WCI owns and operates along the Tillamook Railroad handles about 85% of the internet traffic for the Pacific Rim. It not only affected China, Southern Asia, and India, it also affected part of the traffic coming out of Alaska. And it even extends into the military traffic. So that particular facility, not only the building there at Nadona Beach, really needs to have a status of national significance, and Tom can talk a whole lot better about that than I can. The Owen network. At this point in time, the staff of the PUC reviewed the engineering plans, and we were asked to by the governor's office through Chairman Beyer, and we reviewed it. And you know, as it stands, it's a great project. It has a great potential. It could provide a great service to the state. But from our point of view, it needs to be more than just a wireless network. It needs to be a meshed network that is made up of multiple technologies that can act as a redundancy one for the other. So you utilize the fibers that we have crossing the state in an east and westerly direction, utilize the ones that are going north and south, and from whatever avenue we can gain benefit. I was part of the engineering team back in the early or late 90s when SB 622 came about, and I was looking for routes to affect the routes that were ordered by that Senate bill when I was with Quest. One of the things we found during the December windstorm was the right-of-ways, where they were originally built. They're in some places 100 foot in width, sometimes 200 foot in width. But where the lines come in close proximity to trees that are 100 and 200 foot long, it doesn't do a whole lot of good. But what we'd like to do is see some sort of legislation that allow BPA private utilities to go in and remove danger trees that pose a risk to that infrastructure. This last summer, we had a discussion with Idaho Power, who serves the eastern part of the state, but they had a significant amount of wildfires this last year, and they had an education dilemma with the Forest Service and the BLM, where they were using the right-of-way as a firebreak and setting backfires, and not really giving a whole lot of regard to the pole line that was running through those rights of way until they finally said, these are structures, and you are creating a hazard for us and yourselves by allowing fire to, you know, engulf these structures. So they worked with those federal agencies and the State Department of Forestry and overcome some of that. So that's something else that you might want to think about.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, ma'am.
You said needing legislation allowing utilities to remove the dangerous trees
that are outside the right-of-way.
Outside the right-of-way.
Right.
Okay. I was just trying to understand. So you've got trees just outside the right-of-way that are causing problems.
That could cause have a potential of cause. We call them danger trees.
Okay.
So.
Okay, I got it now. Thanks.
Private and public lands.
Public and private lands, yes, ma'am. And this is my own personal wish. So it's not, I'm not speaking for the PUC here, but, you know, I've been involved now in emergency management since the mandate came down from the governor's office and the PUC was thrown into the mix. And I would certainly wish the legislature would give consideration to deferring any more kicker checks until we can establish a disaster fund of at least $1 billion. And I think that was about the amount of money that was returned to the taxpayers in December.
A little over.
Yes.
A little over.
And maybe we could help communities like the Vernonia and the and the schools, such as like that. That's just my own personal little wish list.
It's noted as your personal wish.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Any more comments, questions? All right. And our final testifier, Michael Muma. Welcome. It's kind of weird for me to say welcome to you because we're guests too.
So, Chair Boone and committee members, I'm Michael Muma. I'm the emergency manager for the city of Beaverton, but I'm here today as the president of the Oregon Emergency Management Association. First, I want to thank you all for bringing your roadshow here. I think this is a great opportunity for us to interact, and I encourage you to do so again, and we will be more than happy to host you whenever we have the chance. I had the opportunity to testify before the committee on December 5th, shortly after the December storms, and I just want to take the opportunity to kind of reinforce some of the priorities we as an association are looking at for public policy as well as the upcoming 2009 legislative session. And several of these support the testimony already provided by our members. Core to these priorities is the need to establish a sound, integrated, comprehensive emergency management program throughout all levels of the state, from the city to the counties, to the state, and even down to the individual level and business and industry. To accomplish this, emergency management must be made a priority in the state rather than an afterthought. This does not apply only to responding to disasters, but also in the planning and preparation ahead of time. For both natural and human-caused hazards, and implementation of programs to lessen or eliminate the potential impacts of these hazards we face. Too often it seems that when budgets become tight, emergency management programs are the first to get the axe. This happens at all levels of our government, as well as in the private sector. Statewide emergency management needs to be integrated so that all emergency management functions work in support of each other. How prepared we are as a state, a county, and a city greatly depends on how prepared we are as individuals and families and businesses. If our residents are not prepared, the local government and the state will never have enough resources to mount a timely and effective response to meet their critical needs. Key to being prepared is the development of a common preparedness message. It has to be used throughout the state. Other public safety programs like the use of seatbelts, not drinking and driving, fire prevention, the use of child safety seats, seatbelts in automobiles have all benefited from the use of common messages in national and statewide public education campaigns. The specific messages of these campaigns have been effectively used on billboards, in schools, and through other public service advertising. And that's a nut we have yet been able to crack as emergency management. The Oregon Trails chapter of the American Red Cross created the Prepare Oregon campaign. However, it never became the common preparedness message that was hoped for. Such efforts need to be supported as a priority at the state level and facilitated in a manner that makes it a benefit, not a burden, to the local programs to participate in them. Emergency management in Oregon needs to be comprehensive. We cannot get caught up in concentrating on a single hazard just because that's where the funding is. We need to be planning and preparing based on our most likely hazards and the greatest potential threats. While each community or region in the state has specific hazards or potential impacts that they face, there are several emergency management functions that are common throughout the state that could benefit from a centralized, coordinated planning effort rather than expecting each jurisdiction to reinvent the proverbial wheel. This coordinated planning effort will also ensure the efforts are integrated. For the fiscal year 2009 legislative session, our priorities calls for a comprehensive approach to emergency management in Oregon. It's not a new idea or a new strategy. For over 12 years, we've been working on getting legislation passed that would create the Comprehensive Emergency Management Act. Our proposed priorities focus on three basic areas. First is establish a disaster fund to assist state agencies. Yes, there was a disaster relief fund passed in the special session. However, it didn't take a form that we feel is what is appropriate or needed. We are, however, open to participating in the writing of the administrative rules in hopes that maybe we can address some of our concerns that we still have with the legislation that was passed. We feel that we need to provide emergency management program funding needs to be provided to establish programs in areas where there are none and to coordinate activities and functions to enhance the current and state and local disaster management system. This is where we would look at increasing funding for OEM so that they can take on a role of overall integrating programs throughout the state. This would be where we talk about the statewide all-hazard incident management teams that Vicki Hargith addressed. We also want to create a state hazard mitigation grant program to fund projects to make our community disaster resilient and reduce the impact of technological and natural hazards. We may not have the funding for it, but maybe we could create some type of incentive-based programs that would encourage developers and property owners to upgrade the buildings that they have. In closing, I want to again offer the collective knowledge and experience of OEMA's members as a professional resource to your committee. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you very much.
Any questions?
Thanks for coming to us, and thanks for having us come to you. Questions? So, Michael, well, thanks again.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. I amen everything you've said. Mr. Murphy can tell you that during the 2005 session, I advocated establishing a Homeland Defense Agency that would have had OEM under that and funding it, and neither my party or the other party saw fit at the co-chair level to fund that, and I think that was a mistake. Again, based upon my background, I think we're not really looking at the threats that are out there to our citizens. Moved to Sun River in 1993, and when you moved to Sun River at that time, you couldn't pull any weeds or cut trees, and you had to have a shake roof. A couple of seasons of fire dangers in the south, and people, we realized we shouldn't have shake roofs and we should clear a fire protection area around your homes. So we've changed our policy, and I think that's some of the things in the state that, you know, people should realize and learn from others' mistakes. I don't know that we can ever afford to have, to be honest, and I'm not in leadership anymore, in my party, but I don't think we'll ever be able to have a definite disaster relief fund. But our rainy day fund should definitely be able to go in there and tap the rainy day fund. You know, we should focus our, you know, getting a rainy day fund built up like we, you know, started this session, and get that and have enough money in there that you could tap that for emergency disasters. I don't know that we could afford, like I said. And, you know, let's think about that as individuals, too. You don't want to have too much money in the bank, but you want to have enough money to use it for whatever disasters. And I really believe in public safety. I think that's the primary function of government is public safety, and you're part of that. I'll do what I can to help Chair Boone and other members of this committee get legislation to help you do your job and protect the citizens.
I'm writing that down.
Yeah, could you give me a sign?
I believe it's tape recorded.
Yeah, we got him.
The Madam Chair, and maybe since Michael's here, did we do an after action report yet on the December storm? Is OEM compiling that and going to lessons learned and mistakes made and things like that? Is that's forthcoming?
I think so. And I see a lot of heads nodding out there.
And we never lost cell phone coverage in the area. Is that true or not?
No, we did.
No, it did. You did.
So we lost everything in some areas.
There was 39 cell towers owned by AT&T Communications, and only one stayed up. Again, that's tied back into the public switch telephone network. It's not a self-reliant network. Again.
And I'm interested in the storm. I have a little condo in Representative Cowan District of Depot Bay, and I've looked at some of the damage out here. Madam Chair, and maybe Michael can comment on this too, but this past week I met with the Redmond Fire Department and the Central Oregon Council on Aging, and I hope part of their planning is we need to identify seniors and people with disabilities that need evacuation assistance, and I guess the Fire Department does a little bit of that, and the Council on Aging is doing that, but some way we need to be sure we're not duplicating the effort. But it's as we get older and older in this state, we need to be sure that we've got a part of our plan is identifying those people that need help.
Chair Boone and Representative Winsett. Yeah, sorry about that. That is true. Not just the our aging population, but we have a vast special needs population that needs to be addressed. Unfortunately, a large number of the facilities, their procedures are very simple and basic. Case of emergency, call 911. We don't have enough resources in a disaster to answer all those 911 calls. And I think there needs to be more emphasis and incentive for the different companies that provide care homes and facilities to help get their plans done. I feel that a lot of them are reluctant to come forward and discuss the inadequacies of their plan because they feel that there might be some discipline involved or regulatory hammer brought down on them. And there's really, this is another one that has to be comprehensively done statewide. There's just not enough resource for it to be done piece by piece. The same resources as City of Beaverton we would call upon to evacuate a nursing home are also being called for by Tigard, Tualatin, the county. It has to be an integrated effort. Feeding into this is we have to look at different standards of care. Right now the expectation is when you evacuate somebody who's bedridden from a facility to another facility or hospital that it will be a certain mode of transportation, a certain level of care. When you're talking about significant numbers of people and few transports provided, we need to have alternatives, and it needs to be recognized so we can pre-plan on the front end rather than an ad hoc plan at the time of. But it seems to be wait till it happens, do the ad hoc planning, throw them in the back of U-Hauls or whatever. Nobody will fault you for it. But I would rather see some of this stuff addressed in planning action on the front end and give us some better planning guide on how to do it in an alternative fashion.
Rep. Cohen, she has
a I can speak a little bit to some of the senior challenges. I guess I'll do that first since it's here. Dating back to a previous disaster, we have kind of annual disasters in Lincoln County. It's not something that it's unusual particularly, but we had one with a significant power outage, and my emergency manager, Jim Hawley, came to me at the time about some concerns of one of the
facilities that serves older individuals was sort of gathering everybody around the fireplace in order to stay warm. Another place were opening their ovens for heat, and he was a little concerned about some of the methodologies. And I brought it up, and we did have some kind of fledgling legislation in the last time, but what I learned in that whole process, not only was I a newbie to the legislature and trying to get my feet under me, I also learned about the myriad of regulatory agencies that they're, well, now, wait a minute, you know, that doesn't apply to our group because we only do this, and then there's this organization over here, and then there's this regulatory process over here. Obviously, I can't repeat all of what I heard because I can't even remember all of it. But we do have to remember that our facilities who care for people, seniors and people with disabilities, run the gamut of a whole host of care needs and at different levels. And I think that we have made some progress in some of those initial things, the most seriously dependent lists of places that need to get their emergency power restored so that they can run oxygen units and things like that. But as you go down, it kind of depends on whether you're in an independent living situation or assisted living situation, et cetera, et cetera. And it is part of the planning process that we need to take into consideration. It isn't as simple and straightforward as it sounds in terms of, okay, you know, this is how our plan deals with all the old people or the physically disabled or whatever. But senior issues are kind of the other piece of my primary interest area, and I'm trying to coordinate those two. But that whole comprehensive planning, I guess the other comment that I just wanted to make as a result of your remarks, Michael, is that I really appreciate hearing them in the sense of comprehensive planning is what's important to me. I made the sort of flippant remark that we have almost annual disasters, but it is true. It's not a matter of if, it's when. We all know something's going to happen, and an incident command system, an ICS organization, whatever, is basically the same. It's just that the problems that we're dealing with are different, and we don't know when we're going to lose all our cell phones. I use the example of the opportunity we got to deal with half of the new Carissa one year, and when Jim called me, I was on the road and called my cell phone, and he said that chip that broke loose out there, it's going to land in Lincoln County, and I said, you're kidding, right? I mean, this is not really the call I expected, and he said, no, I'm not kidding, and at first we thought it was going to hit the rocks, and it would have been a really big mess, and it kindly wandered up on some sandy shore, and we were able to deal with it. But this is not a drill that anybody plans for. And what we discovered was that luckily we had a building in Walport that we could turn into an incident command. We had a tri-level thing with every agency and federal government in the world trying to figure out who was responsible for it. But immediately we didn't have the cell phone capability. Everybody in that building was on their cell phone, and nobody could get a call out. Fortunately, there were mobile units available, and we didn't have natural disasters in terms of weather to deal with, so we were able to get that capability up and running very quickly. But that's what I mean as an example of who would ever have thought this one up. And so I do think that the comprehensive planning is extremely important, and common messaging that I think also, I'm just going to throw in my little two bits worth, needs to include personal responsibility. Yes. And the government will not be knocking on your door in the first 20 minutes of whatever happens, and you really do have to be prepared to take care of yourself for a while, because I don't really care if you're cold. If there's some food in the house and you can make yourself a sandwich and you got some blankets, you'll be fine. Thank you very much. I've got people to take care of who may need something a little more urgent than that. So I really think we need to do the planning. And I'll get off my soapbox here in a minute. We really need to do the planning. We really need to be able to do what is appropriately public safety responsibility. But that message has got to include that may not mean you. That if you can take care of yourself and your family, do it and leave us alone and quit calling 911 to find out what's going on and when my power is going to be restored. And obviously I could go on for some time on this. You know what I mean. Yes. Out there. Yeah. But I really do think we have to have a common message, and there's some things that people just flat need to be told.
I actually got a call asking me when the power was going to go back. I thought, wow, you know.
It brought
I
me
just
back.
Made something up.
It brings me back to all those years my husband has been is a retired school administrator. When everybody called on the first snowflake, is there going to be school tomorrow? No.
Never happens in Bend. Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who would like to come forward, having thought up something while you're listening to all this?
Yeah.
Come on up.
We really need you up here.
Come on up, Scott.
The tape recorder doesn't get you back.
Tape recorder
there.
Is to get. Whoa.
I was going to just be quiet and listen, but you inspired me to come forward.
Good. I'm
now
glad.
You need to introduce yourself one more time into the microphone.
Speaking of.
I'm Scott Backer. I'm the new Emergency Services Coordinator for Curry County. I'm also the commander of the Air Search and Rescue Squadron for Civil Air Patrol in Brookings. And I wish that Mr. Krieger was here today to hear me, but I think with what I'm about to tell you, you can pass this on. Recently, in the last year and a half, with the tsunami concerns, and I've heard this brought up several times today, and then when I heard you say that you would champion a South Coast tsunami preparedness, I thought I would let you know about something I may be able to help you with. I've been testing a speaker system in my aircraft to do an airborne broadcast, and it was based on a request from the Coast Guard about a year and a half ago. Excuse me for my voice. I'm getting over a cold. And I found a speech projection system that you can actually hear very clearly for a long ways away. And that's from the airplane. This system is a land-based system that is 12 times louder than what comes out of my airplanes. I just recently came back from the Hawaiian Islands, and I was requested to do my test for their upgrade to tsunami warnings, and they adopted my plan with speakers to have all of their 8 aircraft be fitted with this system. And it's made by PowerSonics, a West Virginia firm that I founded. And it was through an old search and rescue unit that I started with in 1972. I was with the Air Ops in Placer County, and my captain said, "You've got to come down and listen to this speaker system. You can hear it over and above the rotor noise from a helicopter." Now, coincidentally, I've been working with the owner and Army National Guard unit back in North Carolina that they have a pallet system they want to put in Blackhawks to do the same announcement with this system for nuclear plants that may become a problem. So I would be glad to assist you in the testing I've already done over the year and a half. And I propose that we include this in some funding for our coastline, because an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure when it comes to a tsunami.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, Rep. Cohn.
This looks like a stationary
Yeah, they make
system.
two systems.
I want to ask you, first of all, whether you're basically promoting the aircraft kind of warning or something that's land-based, and then I'll tell you why that question.
Both. And the reason is I was part of the fire chief's summit where we decided to make a test warning that was agreeable to everyone. And some of the comments that came out of the fire chiefs is we better be people away from the firehouses because we're concerned about the World War II sirens that may fly apart when we test them on May 1st. So I did the first testing in Pistol River with one of these sirens. And my concern is that the sirens can be heard for the local community. But I put spotters out on the ocean, and your ocean going or your beachgoers will not hear the sirens unless they're right underneath them. So there's two systems. The aircraft can fly along the beach low and warn the beachgoers, but this system can go for 3 square miles, and I plan on testing it on June 1st in Brookings Harbor and just see how good it is, because I haven't heard that one myself.
I have a follow-up question then.
Yes, ma'am.
From the stationary unit concern, you know, I understand where we're working on common signals and that kind of thing, but mm-hmm. one of the challenges that we've found over the years is that we live at the beach, and coastal climate is not real good for these things. And
right.
So I'm interested in also, as you're doing your testing or as we're moving forward in this, I need some reassurance that these things are not going to be damaged by the coastal climate and that they're actually going to work after we decide they can be heard a year from now when we need them.
Okay, I will get that information from the developer to satisfy that request.
And how much do they cost?
The unit there is $25,000, and the units that are in the aircraft is $8,900. The nice thing is if there's no mixed signals, and from a Homeland Security standpoint, this projects your speech very clearly. Most projection systems are a lot of noise, but you can actually hear what's being said. I've done four or five tests, and I'll be able to offer you testimonials that have come from military units I've tested it with. And the people on the ground actually think it's their radio talking to them on their shoulder, but it's me from the airplane.
I knew you were tan from something other than Oregon. We got it out of it.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Any comments, questions before he leaves?
Okay.
I think I've made that call. Okay. Well, is anybody else willing to come forward? And just before we, I wanted to give the committee member and our guest committee member the opportunity to talk about any legislation that they may be thinking about introducing in 2009 before we close here. And you will be the first to know. And this won't be used in your campaign against you.
Don't worry. Is anyone here from Deschutes County? I'm going to sponsor legislation to give all the money to EM Emergency Management.
To give all the money. Ah, there you go.
First of all, I hope we get through the year without just another special session for the economy going like it is. We'll be looking at the June forecast to see where we are. I've been told by friends and leadership party that I think we may have enough. May have to take the governor's, some of his, Mr. Murphy may lose. I don't know if he got one of those 30%. May have to take some of those raises that the governor gave for a while. Because without... there may be enough there to get by. We only go down $150 million more. But I don't know. I think we'll come back quicker than people are thinking next session. This was a great session for money, for funding. And I'm on education and judiciary. And so education, you know, had $6.245 billion out of a budget that's about $15 billion, $16 billion. And so we had 20% more revenue this time than we had in the previous biennium, and that's great because we were able to fund some things and bring things back from the economic downturn we had in the early 2000s. So that was good for education and for a lot of other things. We did get the rainy day fund started, which I think is very important to the state of Oregon with our current tax structure of two legs of the stool, not three. But you look around, I don't know if my colleagues have looked around the other states. I mean, we came out, we're pretty good as far as deficit compared to Arizona. They're down like $1.6 billion. Washington's down about over $1 billion that they're short. So I don't know what next session is going to bring forth, but I'm sure my colleagues and myself are going to do the best we can. And again, I state my public safety is why we're in business, and that involves emergency management and state police and all the other public safety. Over here in Sun River, we're worried about fires and earthquakes. And so that's, we have a, you know, when I first moved here, we didn't have two exits out of Sun River. And we had to get a bridge built across the river to get a second exit out from certain areas and stuff. So you're, thank you for what you do. It's an important job. And I'm sure you feel like you get cut a lot and don't have the resources to do your job. But it's important. And thank you for doing your service to Oregon and its citizens. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And just so it'll make you feel better, the market was up on Friday.
Yes.
I don't know what it's doing today. I haven't checked.
Down a little bit.
Down a little bit. Thanks.
Well, these guys can check. Now, I'm staying in Sun River. It's okay. I'm safe. I'm not going to have a fire, and I can get out if there's an earthquake, right?
No, Sisters is
okay,
there's still some steam coming up from Middle Sisters. You have to watch for that earthquake.
Okay. All right. Good
one.
Thanks.
Have anything on your list you want to share?
I made a few notes. I was interested when she whispered this in my ear. You know, I don't have any specific pieces of legislation, and my challenge going into the legislature has been all along that I'm not a real believer in grabbing some idea and fighting for it till the end, because I really do think we need to make everything work together, and I tend to work within the existing structure and try to push some budgetary direction in places that we already have. I've already made my comments about aging issues being extremely important to me, and that's kind of the cloak that I've taken on, or a whole lot of details around seniors' long-term care issues. But I throw emergency planning into that as well, and that it crosses over nicely between some of those responsibilities. And let's remember, this committee is Emergency Preparedness and Ocean Policy. That was a little bit of a challenge. It was probably because we had two issues that we needed to talk about, and so we lumped them together. But most of us that sit on the committee have a lot of interest in both of those. And again, as I said, I'm interested in generically looking at disasters and not being real specific. Although while Representative Wisnett worries about earthquakes over here, where I come from, we worry about earthquakes too, but it's because they generate tsunamis. So it all goes together. I do think that outreach in public education is extremely important for the kinds of reasons that I've already detailed, and some other things that are rather unique to us. Beach safety awareness. We've lost a couple of people in the ocean this winter. It never ceases to amaze me. What do you mean you were swimming in December? Hello. When that wave just came in and grabbed them, gee, you know. There's a lot of public education that needs to take place. But I think some of the things I heard mentioned here today that are particularly important to me are that whole communication system. And I encourage the expertise in this room to be part of all of those ongoing conversations. I know just enough about some of these issues to be really dangerous and have no expertise whatsoever on all of the details. I just want this stuff to work. Yes, I understand that what redundancy means, and I know how important it is. I don't much care who owns all this stuff. I just want it to work in an emergency. And during the December storm, Lincoln County was really split. Much of our county was not really impacted by it. Your place in Depot Bay was fine. Lincoln County, or Lincoln City, was so totally out of communication that we didn't have any idea what was going on up there. I, by the way, wrote out that storm in Arizona, which is a terrible place to be when something's going on at home. And I'm was just thankful that my cell phone, still had connectivity to my spouse, so that I could keep kind of abreast. Otherwise, I would have been crazy, because we were actually hearing about the Oregon coast on national news in Arizona, and that makes me really nervous when that happens. So that whole communication system, we have to find ways for it to work together. The disaster relief piece that we got in the last session is something that we've worked on for years, and it's a step. But we do need to recognize that connectivity between state government and local government, and what we do at the state level and how that impacts our local partners. Because I come out of local government, that's something that folks in the legislature hear from me a great deal. But your local governments, your county governments, are no more capable of picking up that 25% that FEMA doesn't cover than any of us are at the state level, and I do think we need to keep building on that, as well as coordinating what we do to learn from each other. As we talk about coastal planning, some of the tsunami planning, you know, each of us up and down the coast have done a variety of things, and I think that we've got to put those together. Let's not recreate the efforts all the way along. And finally, I want to mention mitigation, because I do think that that's something that it's important for you folks to keep taking back to your constituents as well. We have a whole lot of really funny-looking places along the Siletz River that are built up on stilts because we made them do that before they reconstructed after two or three floods. And now they're calling Jim and thanking him for what he did because they weren't flooded the last time. So we need to think about not redoing our mistakes as well. And finally, I think it's the other ocean challenges that we've got to kind of keep in this whole picture, because this is a committee that deals with both of those. I don't know yet what the legislation is going to look like exactly, because there's still too much conversation going on. But in the world of ocean policy, we will be needing to come forward with something, too. So I'm just putting everybody on the record, I guess, here. In terms of just comprehensively planning again, or ocean zoning, or whatever else you want to call it, we've got all of these challenges out there. We've got potential for marine reserves, potential for wave energy exploration. We've got cables coming ashore that are really important to a lot of you people. And what ties all of this together is adequate mapping. And we tried to get some undersea mapping through the last couple of efforts in 07 and 08, and nobody's been really too excited about hearing that from us, and maybe we need some help from others talking about the importance of getting good offshore mapping completed. Part of it is because of the inundation and the run-up from a tsunami. You got to see what it looks like out there before you can decide what's going to come up on shore. And we also need it so that we can look at the bottom and help between all of those competing interests that we have out there in the ocean. And then finally, the piece of that has come up to me recently that I really do think is going to need some attention legislatively is, as we get some of the various kinds of mapping done, who owns that knowledge base? That's very, very important to the fishing community as we try to access where is their hot spots. Is it to use it for or against them, if you will? So there are interesting arguments going on out there in this whole world, and they do roll nicely together, but there's some stuff that I think we're really going to have to be aware of. It's too early to tell exactly what proposals are going to look like, but I'm thinking about things.
And I love it. I get the last word. But she provided me a great segue into it. And I plan to be as annoying as possible next session again on the seafloor mapping issue. And this time around, we have the extra oomph of the governor having put a request to the federal delegation for $4 million, which will cover about a third or a little more of it. If we can get that from the federal people, then we can pony up some locally, and it's exactly what we need. There's a lot of applications for it. I intend to continue to advocate for finishing the Owen system, and taking in mind some of the recommendations that came forward today, in addition to the wireless piece of it. I already talked about my coastwide emergency preparedness. I'm going to be doubly annoying on, once again, trying to get a very small but somewhat significant volunteer firefighter EMS / whatever first responder tax credit. We've got one for EMS people. We need to take it down to first responder level, and we need to take it to firefighter. These are our first responders, and in some of the areas in our state, and I don't know where you all are from, but some areas there, these are the only people who respond, and they are tireless volunteers. They are out of pocket for everything, and one of the biggest things that we talked about last time, how much do you need, what would be significant, you know, all these things, and everybody came up with, well, there's the training costs, there's cleaning your gear, and especially after an EMS call, you can't just take it home and put it in the washer. I'm sorry. And not all departments have, you know, the industrial washer and agents that you need to clean it. So there's that. And then there's gas. I mean, look at the price of gas between last year and now. And it was significant then, and now it's really significant. So I'm going to try that one again. And what happened last time was basically people said, oh, there's 8,000 volunteer firefighters or whatever you want to call them in the state. That's too many. That means this much money. But I think it came up to about, what, a couple $1 million?
Wasn't that?
There's a bunch of tax credits. There's a book this thick of tax credits. A lot of them could go bye-bye as far as I'm concerned. And I'm not going to get into that. That's a whole other can of worms. But if we have to, we'll find some that we can maybe retire if they're not being used in a way that this could be. And I don't know how many of you are volunteers, but probably a good number of you in here and people who will be coming this week. So, and I'll get off my little soapbox on that. And then the final one that we're probably going to, I'll see this lovely partner of mine with me on marine research. And that was one of the biggest messages that came out yesterday. And this was we were talking about salmon disaster issues of the salmon disaster we're experiencing now. And it came out from the fishermen and the people who just live and work in the community, make their living off fishing and ocean stuff. They all said that we don't know what's out there. And the people doing the mapping, I want to just respond really quickly to that. Some of those are the same people, same researchers, doing mapping and research. They all work together. And I'm the kind of person who, if you say you're a wave energy project going in and you need to know what's on the bottom so you know where to put your anchors, et cetera. Well, if you're going to pay for mapping, why not pay the OSU mapping lab that's already in place doing it, or even take the guys down in California who are coming up here to do some mapping because they've got the boat. And for 2 whole weeks this summer, we're going to get some help on that. But why not do that and then share it? Because you have to share it eventually anyway. And I get the whole thing about the fishing industry and not telling people where your hot spots are. But as far as getting the mapping done, and I know you probably know this, it's only 5% or 6% that has been finished. And we're just talking about the 3 mile out from the shore bathymetric mapping. Some of it's and some of you might have boats and use nautical charts. Well, some of those are from the 1800s. That's scary to me because that's where some of the emergency response comes in. What if somebody like the new Carissa cracks up that? So I'm not saying that was a mapping problem.
They managed to anchor somewhere that perhaps wasn't the wisest place to anchor.
Yeah, but in any case, the applications are multiple, and it's a good thing to have, and it will need money. And just like the research. And so we're going to see, this committee is going to be busy. I hope I get to keep it, and I'm looking forward to that. But anyway, we do have some things planned, and hopefully for just a rip-snorting session. And working, we have Gene, I have him on, will help Debbie Boone with anything she wants. Is that what you said?
I think it was something like that, wasn't it?
So I have one of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle that I'll just be buttonholing constantly. So. In any case, we're about finished here, and I really want to thank you again for inviting us to be part of this day, and we are always happy to come and speak to you, but we'd really love it even more if you'd come and speak to us. And for those of you who are regulars to my committee, you're always welcome, and you know that when things change, come forward again. Michael, I've taken copious notes on some of the requests that have come through today, and we'll get together with our record keepers here. But thanks again, and I hope you have a really great week here. You're going to be here all week. I have to leave tomorrow, but I'm going to come in as much as I can. I'm going to probably have to leave about noon. So thank you, and we stand adjourned.